From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Sick of winter? What I find helps besides the occasional warmish sunny day is thinking about tomatoes. And that's what we're going to do today with Craig LaHoulier, author of the hit 2014 book Epic Tomatoes, who has over the years grown some 3,000 varieties in his home garden and adds new ones to his list every year. More in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, the leading publisher in books that share wonders with the natural world, including A Way to Garden by Margaret Roach. The stunning guide imparts decades of plant wisdom and challenges readers to think beyond their garden borders and to consider the ways gardening can enrich the world. Available everywhere books are sold and at timberpress.com. They invite you to come grow with them.
Craig LaHoulier, who gardens in North Carolina, is a retired chemist with a longtime passion for tomatoes. He's the co-founder of the Dwarf Tomato Project, an advisor on tomatoes to Seed Savers Exchange, and the person who in 1990 named the popular heirloom Cherokee Purple from seed that had been passed down and eventually made its way to him. Hi, Craig. How are you?
I'm fine, Margaret. Good morning. Great to be here. It's
yes.
So wonderful. Yeah.
Tomatoes.
Tomatoes. And, you know, I woke up this morning and it was 25 degrees and there's frost on the grass. And so tomatoes are now still in the dream state, but they're coming.
Yeah. So before we get started, I'm going to buy a copy of Epic Tomatoes, your great book that has like 80,000 copies in print. What way to go, Craig. I'm going to buy a copy for a giveaway with a transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. And I was so glad to reconnect with you with the excuse of our recent New York Times garden column that we worked on together with Joe Lample, our mutual friend, too, who's your partner in this upcoming Growing Epic Tomatoes virtual course, right? And I think that starts soon, doesn't it?
It starts very soon. And in fact, Joe will essentially hijack my life for the next few weeks as we do some, last year was the launch, and we actually created the course as we went along. What's going to be great about it this year is that it's essentially done now, and it's self-paced. So people will be able to just take their time, work their way through it. And working with Joe was just an absolute joy. So any chance I get to interact with either one of you makes my day.
Oh, that's sweet. And I think people, then you have like weekly live chat, so to speak, like office hours and all kinds of things for people as they're learning, they can ask questions and
Hence the hijack. Great. And there's nothing like, you know, when I look at a book and when you said 2014, it feels like yesterday. So I'm getting older faster because it's been 8 years since that book came out. But that book was written at a point in time, 2012, 13, 14. And what the course allows us to do is to make that book alive and up to date, and we incorporate everything that I've learned in the 7 or 8 years since. So what an opportunity to be able to make a book come to life.
Right. So I followed your tomato adventures for many years, and I continue to do so on your blog, and I'll give the link to that with a transcript. And on Instagram, you're at NC Tomato Man, I think. And One thing that we'd never talked about before, though, that you brought up when we were doing the Times interview was the amazing diversity of heirloom tomato varieties. Like, I would have been off by many times over if you had asked me to guess how many there were. And what did you tell me? There's like 12,000 known varieties or something?
Well, so how I look at it is there's 10 to 12,000 varieties that have different names. And it would take a lot of unscrambling using DNA fingerprinting and sleuthing work to find out, does that 12,000 named varieties really correspond to, say, 3 or 4 or 5,000 actually genetically distinct varieties? And what happens, let's say, you know, somebody named Joe is growing an heirloom called German Johnson, and Joe's family forgets that it's German Johnson. And 10 years after they get it, what is that tomato? Oh, that's Joe's favorite. Bingo. German Johnson for that family now is Joe's favorite. And so you see this type of a personalization of tomato names has happened probably countless times since the mid 1800s when Americans, we decided tomatoes weren't poisonous after all. And, you know, so this love affair in our country has really not been going on for all that long when you think about it, the mid 1800s.
Right. So the 12,000-ish number came from the Seed Savers Exchange, what, the annual yearbook or something?
It's their yearbook and it's their database. And what they do is they track all of the varieties that have come in with different names through all the years. So since the SSE got started in 1975, that 12,000 number does incorporate everything that essentially has passed through their records in the intervening 40-plus years.
Wow. Well, it's pretty impressive. And those are heirlooms. And then there's modern varieties too. So, oh my goodness, you know.
Now is the time, Margaret. I mean, 2022, who would have thought that we're gardening and growing tomatoes at the best time in history for all of that diversity to stick into our gardens?
Yeah. So you've grown like 3,000 of these guys or some crazy number. When you look at the catalogs, like we're all thumbing through the catalogs still, you know, January and then February. And when you look at the catalogs, you look at the pictures, you read the descriptions, like what are you looking for? Or maybe even better, what do you see when you look at the listings? I mean, you know, does the shape, is it that what you think? Oh, the fluted ones. I love those. You know what I mean? Or is the color, does the color say something to you? Like what's you've tried a lot of them.
Yeah. And you know, what's great about that question, number one, no one's ever asked me. And number two, I've got a very unique approach in that having such a huge collection of seeds, I essentially look through seed catalogs more to figure out what's new and different, what's coming back again. I probably will never order another tomato seed from a catalog for the rest of my life. Seriously, because I've got it. I've got them all. I've got browns and purples. And what I find is happening is the things that are ending up in catalogs these days, it's the flashy colors, it's the flashy names. It's typical marketing 101 that we've used in this country forever. It's not snake oil selling. It is how do I get people's attention? I've got a red yellow tomato and it's named X. Well, I've got another red yellow tomato, but I need to name it Y because I want to get a piece of that action, sell it. So I'm a little amused when I look at the catalogs at the efforts that's made to make things interesting. The cover variety, you know, Burpee and Parks and all these companies have always put on these beautiful cover tomatoes too. So I'm glad I'm not a seed company because the competition out there is brutal to get gardeners' attention right now.
Right. You said that you'll never have to buy any more seed. Mm. And another thing I learned from you recently was that you have some seed that you've been saving for many years and it's still viable, right?
Well, tomato seed I've found has about it goes off a cliff at about 14 to 15 years. So what I do is I regrow it each time and ensure that it doesn't cross-pollinate in my garden. So for example, Cherokee Purple, which I've been growing every year since 1990, it's now 2022. And I have files on my computer that are PowerPoint that essentially tell the genealogical story of that tomato in my hands, which year I grew it from, what it traces back to. And I do that because if I end up with something I don't expect, if I get a red one or a brown one, I can go back then and know, well, this lot of seed must have some cross-pollinated seed in it. And when I want to grow it next year, I will go to a different lot. So I have maybe 80 different separate vials of Cherokee Purple representing all of the times I've grown it in the last 40 years. Yes, I'm insane, but it's okay.
Yeah. And where do you store your seed, all those vials? Where are they stored?
Yeah. So some of them are behind me in my office. Some of them are in my basement. And I don't do what the big Svalbard Seed Vault does, what the USDA germplasm does, which is they dry them down and they store them at temperatures where they'll last 50 or 100 years. This is an issue that I have with my seed because I'm storing them at room temperature. I'm getting maybe 10 to 12 years out of them. So I have this onus on me to make sure that everything in my collection is sitting somewhere else that is safe, whether it be the Seed Savers Exchange, the USDA, a seed company, Svalbard, because I don't want anything to go extinct when it's sitting in my hand, so to speak. I want to make sure that they're always alive for somebody to grow out somewhere. That makes what I'm doing a little bit that much more complex, I think.
Lark, a little mini lightning round of some varieties. Is there something that you're growing this year you've never grown before? Is there one you can name?
This year is really cool because 2 years ago I thought, I had this little experiment. let's say I love Cherokee Purple and I love Lillian's Yellow, and there's lots of heirlooms I love. Well, what happens if I take those two and make a hybrid out of them? Well, I love the hybrid. So I did that. I did that 8 different times with 16 of my favorite tomatoes. Last year, the best tomato in my garden was the hybrid that was Cherokee Purple times Lillian's Yellow heirloom. Joe grew it as well. Other people I sent, you know, when you create a hybrid, you only end up with maybe 40 or 50 seeds. So I was very careful of who got to grow those out, but I saved seeds from them. And so this year, I want to save room in my garden to grow out some of the offspring from that hybrid, because there'll be different color combinations and different flavors, and it will be just fascinating. So that's the Mr. Wizard part of my gardening that I have to dip into each year, because that keeps me interested. I'm going to have mysteries in my garden. I'm going to have questions that I can answer. But the other thing I did the last 2 years is, because Hendersonville is such a better tomato growing climate than Raleigh was.
Where you moved from, right.
Yeah. We had one day at 90 degrees last year. We had humidity that was extremely tolerable. So I had essentially little to no blossom drop. My yields were off the roof. So I went back and got a lot of my favorites that were starting to struggle for me in Raleigh. And we're talking Nepal and Polish and yellow brandywine. And they blew my socks off again last year. And what's comforting about that is you've got things you've loved and they no longer are performing for you because the climate in your garden has shifted. So where those varieties are no longer happy, and you move to a place where they're happy again. So I fell in love once more with maybe a dozen of my favorite tomatoes. And I know it's kind of like Valentine's Day was a few days ago, but it's the same type of feeling, right?
Sweet.
Well, what it convinces you is that if you love the flavor of tomato and you do a good job of keeping it so that it doesn't cross-pollinate, you should be able to keep loving that tomato each year you grow it. Like I said, though, unless the climate shifts to a point where it no longer sets fruit, or then it becomes a disease magnet, you know, things like that.
Right. So you have you and Joe, when you teach the course and in your own gardens at home, you have sort of a timeline. You ask us to, you like an 8-week seedling, and you ask us to count back 8 weeks from our frost date and get started. And we've talked before on the show a number of years ago about your dense sowing method, how you don't just put one or two seeds in a cell, you densely sow a number of each one in more of a larger cell or whatever, or a community pot, so to speak.
Yeah, actually the same type cell. So I've got that 50 plug flat that I like, that's about 1.5 by 1.5 inch square. And so maybe an example would be, there's a fellow named Phil Shackelford who had a family heirloom, and he sent me two seeds. So I planted one and it germinated, and that variety is now in the Victory Seed Catalog. And Phil is now all excited that his family heirloom can be shared, and it's the biggest tomato I've ever grown. But what I want to do illustratively, next to it was Sun Gold, which I liked. People were buying a lot of Sun Gold seedlings for me. So I would sow 50 to 75 seeds in that same type cell. And you end up, and it really is an efficiency trick. And certainly not everybody has to or even should do this, but it is possible. And that's because if you wanted to create 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 seedlings, you can do it with two plug flats in a very small footprint in your office or growing area. Whereas if you were to do 2, 3, 4 seeds a cell to create the same number of plants, every surface in your house would be covered with growing. So it really was just something that I learned about, you can be efficient. And, you know, some of the people that have gotten the biggest benefit out of the dense planting are not even the tomato growers. It is the beet growers. When I discovered that you can dense plant beets, and because each beet seed is actually a cluster of actual seeds, you don't have to thin the beets in your garden anymore. You can just thin the beets out, one little plant to a plug flat, and then plop those plugs into your garden every 3 inches. You get these perfect round beets. Now, you do have to enjoy playing in the dirt, spending hours at the bench, separating out seedlings, using a gentle touch. But I find that extremely therapeutic. When my hands are with seedlings or with potting mix, that's when I'm actually at my happiest. And so I don't mind doing that, but it isn't for everyone, but it's out there as a tool to use for those who need it.
Right. So you started doing it and Joe does it because he does a plant sale and you used to do a plant sale back in Raleigh and so forth. And so you'd grow thousands.
Right.
But even for those of us, like say you want to do sauce or canning of tomatoes and you want 12 of a particular variety. And by the way, what's a great heirloom for canning? I know Roma's the classic.
Well, so Martino's Roma is probably the best of the Roma types, but to me, Roma is still, it is a canning tomato. It's a sauce tomato. It's not my favorite fresh eating.
Right.
So what I've gone with is things like Golden Oxheart or Anna Russian or Canselmo. They're the big 1 pound heart-shaped varieties, which because they have this genetic trait to have very few seeds and very dense flesh, they work for canning and sauce making equally as well as the typical traditional Roma types, but they have a much higher flavor intensity to them. So you end up with much better flavored sauce using those types.
So let's say I wanted to do a row. I was going to, you know, maybe with my cherry tomato, with I might have one plant because I'm a small household, but like if I wanted to do my sauce for the year or whatever, I might have 6 or might have 12 plants.
Right.
So, So if I wanted to dense sow those 8 weeks before frost, before the transplant date, I could put those instead of, again, like taking up 12 cells, two six packs, I could have them in one little one cell or in a 3.5 inch pot, you know, a community pot. And I have a small light, and I'm just trying to illustrate for people that even if they're not doing a giant plant sale of thousands of plants, I would, that would only be taking up that little square for the first 4 weeks of its life, those 12 plants. And I would be able to move my lettuce seedlings through my under my lights because I just have a small light rig. And maybe some of my kale, early kale and some other early things in and out, in and out, in and out before those 12 babies were ready to be potted on into their own individual cells for the second 4 weeks of their life, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, I've used that community pot 3.5 inch for lettuce often, and where I'll take maybe 15 or 20 types of lettuce and just do teeny pinches of each in that 1 3.5 inch pot, and then it germinates. Maybe I'll have 50 or 60 plants, but they're all different colors. And then once I start to decide what I'm going to transplant, I can choose what I think would be an attractively colored mix when I pluck those out and either put them in individual containers. What I like to do with lettuce is move them to 6 to 9 plants for a 3-inch pot. They really don't mind root disturbance at all. You can, you know, there are certain plants that are a little bit fussy, but others, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, lettuce, greens, you can be kind of abusive on them as you're moving them around and transplanting them. And they don't, sometimes I feel like they just get relieved when they find fresh potting mix and a nice drink of water and they get separated from their friends.
Well, and you know, if you see in nature, when a plant self-sows, it frequently densely self-sows.
Yes.
So it's not that we're doing something to them that's not almost natural.
Yeah, I think what we do sometimes with gardeners is more unnatural by trying to make everything so separate and tidy. And that,
symmetrical,
Yeah, that is a fantastic analogy you just made, because the best way I've seen Mexico midget varieties grow is to have a container where they grew in, they self-seed. All of a sudden, you've got these little clusters of 15 or 20 tomato plants coming up where each little cherry tomato fell. They're coming out of the husk of that dry tomato.
Correct.
And you just kind of separate them out, put them in your garden. Cherry tomatoes are equivalent to weeds. You can't kill them. You can just, you can only hope to contain them.
So one of your other tricks, tips I love, and it's, I guess, because it's the same way I do it. I gave up on using those domes, you know, that come with the seed flats or getting domes to go with seed flats. And I use plastic wrap and you use plastic wrap. So after we've sown and we have our medium is moistened and we've sown and we've sprinkled some more, I think you use your colander to shake some, filter some more medium over the babies and mist it again. You put plastic wrap on, right?
Yep. Just loose. And the only downside of using it is anybody who's ever used a Saran or a cling or whatever, it is so clingy. So you really have to be careful as you flip it each day, because it will. So there are very few times people hear me swear in the garden. One is when the hose kinks. The other is when the plastic wrap all kinks onto itself, and I have to keep getting fresh pieces of it.
And but, you flip it every day in order to keep disease down, or what?
Yeah, because so I've got a heat mat, and that's moist medium, which means that in the room is a little bit cooler. So each morning when I look in at that, condensation has formed as the warm soil meets. And what I don't want is that same moisture touching the top of those seedlings day after day after day, because damping off is the biggest enemy of very young seedlings. And by doing that daily flip, that means the plants get reunited with a nice dry side of that plastic wrap each day. And then the wet part, which is now on the top facing out, that dries during the day. So you just can use that same piece, flip it. And I've never had a damping off problem since I've gone with that.
Yeah, I normally, the babies are up, I not only remove the heat mat, but I also usually get rid of the plastic or the, you know what I mean? I don't leave it once they're well up and growing.
Right. No, yeah. So if I've got 50 cells or 50 different types of tomatoes, there will be some natural variation on the timing of those. And once just about the majority of them have poked their head off, you're right, that plastic.
Yes.
But then you've got to really watch your watering, because you're densely planted. Those plants are going to draw up more water.
Yes.
And that's the other enemy of a young seedling, that's so shallowly planted seed. Those seeds aren't that deep yet. So you can dry that off pretty quick. You got to just watch your watering. But once you get the hang of that whole technique, it's a game changer. And I don't even think about it. It goes by so easily and so fast that I get a little disappointed, because it is one of my favorite parts of the gardening season, is sowing seeds and watching them come up. More fun than, you know, trying to tie a 10-foot plant to a stake and having it break off in a thunderstorm and, you know, all that stuff.
So we have maybe like 3 minutes left, speaking of 10-foot plants, how about the opposite of those? I want you to kind of put in the pitch for us to look, and I believe the Victory Seeds catalog has all your... you and your collaborators, dwarf tomato project varieties. And I think you call them like, it's the heirloom experience without all the pruning and staking and whatever. Give us the pitch for those.
I will. And the other thing I want to alleviate is the confusion, because I'll get a lot of emails. Well, are dwarfs determinant or indeterminate? I said, well, think of them as the advantages of a determinant in terms of ability to grow in a short cage or a short stake, but the advantages of the indeterminate as being gradually fruiting throughout the season until frost. So what they do is, I tell people, if your Cherokee Purple is 8 feet tall by August, your corresponding dwarf type will be 4 feet tall. The dwarf always holds that 1/2 height ratio with the indeterminate variety. That makes them very useful. So you can get 20, 25 pounds of fruit off a plant. The key is to keep them healthy and happy, give them adequate feeding. We now have 145 varieties out. Our 14 new ones are some of my favorites. Dwarf Eagle Smiley, which is a yellow dwarf growing cherry that tastes just about like sun gold. And we've got Dwarf Chocolate Heartthrob, which is a chocolatey colored tomato with green stripes on it. I mean, we've gone nuts. I am the mad scientist. But really, but I owe it to the talents of the 1,000 or so people that have helped us since 2006 to play in the garden with us and to grow the seeds I send and send me back the seeds they save and help me analyze them and decide where we go next. The book is still not written yet. It is still in my head, but the Dwarf Tomato Project, which I will call crowd breeding, will be out hopefully within the next year, because it is such a story. No one has ever really done this type of a large scale collaborative breeding project using all amateurs and volunteers and none of us getting paid a cent. We've done it for the altruistic joy of bringing something new to gardeners. And it's been the most fun I've had in gardening ever, I think.
And they would be great in containers for those of us who have limited space, right? They would be great for that.
The catalyst for the project were all of the questions I'd get during seedling sale. I want to grow a Cherokee Purple or a Lillian's Yellow. What have you got that grows great and looks like it, but I can do it in a 5-gallon pot? And the answer in 2004 was not a whole lot. And now the answer in 2022 is a whole lot.
145.
Yeah, 145 and counting. So yes, you know, I keep trying to retire, Margaret, but it's not working.
Yeah, I'm having the same issue over here, Craig. Well, Craig LaHollier, Mr. Epic Tomato, I wish you good luck with the course. And as I said, with the transcript of the show, we'll give links to all that. We'll have a book giveaway of Epic Tomatoes. And I'm always glad to talk to you. And I feel better, even though my house is surrounded by a sheet of ice still, I feel better thinking about tomatoes. So thank you, as ever.
It is always a joy. I had such a great time. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, the leading publisher in books that share wonders with the natural world, including A Way to Garden by Margaret Roach. The stunning guide imparts decades of plant wisdom and challenges readers to think beyond their garden borders and to consider the ways gardening can enrich the world. Available everywhere books are sold and at timberpress.com. They invite you to come grow with them.
And thanks to all the rest of you for tuning in too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher or on Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy tomato dreaming and gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.